protection, wasting time on the unemployment line. Hi, everybody. We're back with Manuel Cuyoyo, Eric Mann, FM 90.7, KPFK. And our first guest is Rahul Mahajan, who's a writer, anti-war activist, blogger, and person who debates me on the elections in NYU. How are you doing, Rahul?
Hi, good to be with you again, Eric.
Good to be with you. Very outspoken person, and we appreciate it. Rahul, I want to start by asking you to maybe help us go beyond your excellent commentary this morning, the inauguration, democracy, and the Iraqi elections, which I just want to end with. I mean, basically, as I read your commentary, the first thing you're saying is that the Shiites, of course, are the majority of the people, and if there's a so-called, quote, democratic election, they in the past had been, as I understand it, subordinated under the Saddam Hussein regime.
Yes, although I think, I mean, there's a great deal of conventional wisdom that has evolved about this that is not strictly accurate. It is true, as the conventional wisdom suggests, that Sunni Arabs overall, on average, had a privileged place under Saddam. It's also true that Shiites in the south and Kurds in the north were the ones that particularly bore the brunt of some of his largest and worst atrocities on his own population in the late 1980s, and then again in 1991 when the uprising was put down. But it's not true that it was somehow it's not a good analogy to think of it as you know, like white versus black in the pre-civil rights movement south. There was far more integration of that. There were Shia and Kurds at higher levels of power, and you know, it's true in aggregate, but it's not as extreme as the way a lot of people paint it.
No, absolutely, and I think where I'm going with this, which I want your opinion on, obviously, and or even help us understand, is in that you have this quote, perhaps the most sensible position on the election has come from Mokata al-Sadr, a man who inherited his authority from his father. Until recently, I'm quoting you, he had taken a low profile in the election in investigating the possibility of running some of his own candidates. Now, however, while stopping short of calling for a boycott, he says, quote, I personally will stay away from the elections until the occupiers stay away from them and until our beloved Sunnis participate in them. Otherwise, they will lack legitimacy and democracy. The question, I guess, is that we live in a world of constrained choices for a while. We have a U.S. occupation. It is going to be somewhat of a puppet government, U.S.-inspected election, U.S. government inspection election. What do you think the post-electoral contradictions are going to be? What do you think the different forces of resistance are within each group? Because obviously it's not like all the Sunnis are against the government, as you pointed out, or all the Shiites are for it, and all the Kurds are. What contradictions do you see, including the United States now considering, you know, expanding its attacks on Iran? Where do you see the post-game fight going on?
Well, let me deal with the contradictions just with regard to Iraq.
Sure.
And then get to Iran. There's several even there. So one of the interesting things is that Muqtada al-Sadr, of course, is always portrayed as the extremist among the Shiites. It's Ayatollah Sistani, the good moderate, and Muqtada al-Sadr, the bad extremist. And it is true that in terms of sort of conventional left secularist politics, it is true that Muqtada al-Sadr believes in an Islamic theocracy, and Sistani does not, or at least not quite. But you see here an interesting dynamic where people always try to say, oh, the United States must stay in Iraq because if we leave, there will be civil war. But it is Sistani, the person who is much more closely aligned with the occupying forces, that is pushing forward with this election, which is really almost designed to be the ultimate wedge between the Shia and Sunni populations, and which is every day increasing these sectarian differences, while it's Muqtada al-Sadr, who the extremist, who is actually reaching out to the Sunni in a way that no other major Shia figure has done. He's acknowledging the fact that the Sunni are, for one reason or another, not going to be voting in this election, and he's saying that that's fundamentally wrong. So there's one of the main contradictions and things to watch. After the election, what happens to reach out to try to heal the divisions that have been exacerbated between Sunni and Shia, and that in particular have been very much exacerbated by U.S. colonial policy. Another contradiction is that since the so-called transfer of sovereignty, it looks as if the United States has put a lot of its marbles or eggs or whatever you want to call it in Ayad Alawi's basket. They have built him up as a dictator, as a replacement for Saddam. Apparently, U.S. government advisors to the Iraqi government refer to him as Saddam Light behind closed doors, and there's a good reason for that. And the evolution of Alawi as a dictatorial leader of a police state has become a fundamental part of U.S. policy. However, the way the election has shaped up, Alawi is almost certain to be elected to the National Assembly, but his party and the slate he's leading will not get that many of the votes, and he'll be in a position of having to jockey with the United Iraqi Alliance, which has far more electoral power after the election. So one of the questions will be, since the United States has staked so much on Alawi, is Alawi somehow going to manage to maneuver back into a position of power, either prime minister or perhaps something like interior minister with control of the security? And of course, the related question, or perhaps the related question, is will this new Iraqi government start to show any signs whatsoever of independence from U.S. dictates? So far, after the transfer of sovereignty, if anything, the Iraqi government is even more close to U.S. dictates than it was before the transfer of sovereignty. So those are two of the big questions in terms of Iraq's evolution after the election, and of course they have obvious repercussions for us here in terms of the movement. With regard to Iran, it's very complex, and the big question really one has to ask oneself is how crazy are these guys, or more specifically, how much do Bush and his neoconservative advisors really believe in the power of force? Because that's what neoconservatism is, believing that if you use enough force, then you can get anybody on your side, especially those people in, you know, that part of the world, Arabs and so on, who supposedly respect only force. And probably a lot of his neocons think that Iranians are Arabs too. I wouldn't be surprised. That's the question. Any kind of realistic military appraisal says an invasion is simply out of the question, and that a smaller strike that a lot of people have been talking about on Iran's nuclear facilities suffers from the problem that they simply don't have enough information, and if they did a strike, there's no way they could really seriously believe that they could hit all of the sites, and therefore they might well just simply exacerbate the danger instead of doing anything to contain it. That's a sort of logical realist position. I think it will have a lot of force in the debates that come, but of course the neoconservative force worshiping position has now become pretty clear and crystallized, and it's going to be a big question.
On the phone we have Rahul Mahajan, writer with EmpireNotes.org, who's talking to us about his latest dispatch called The Inauguration, Democracy in the Iraqi Elections. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and you listen to Voices from the Front Lines. Raul, I'd like to go back a little bit to this question around the inauguration speech that Bush did. And I know both the New Yorker magazine that came out last week talking about, you know, the new U.S. foreign policy sort of covert war that they're planning to implement, and in fact it's even written in CIA reports that I looked at this weekend where it's talking about using, you know, covert operatives inside governments to do selective killings, doing random acts of, you know, violence and terrorists, even actually joining terrorist networks and even pulling off some of the terrorist acts against the United States almost. I mean, basically that's what they're calling out, given that they want to bring down some of the unfriendly governments that they claim to be unfriendly governments toward the United States. Where is George Bush? I don't know if you got a chance to hear where Eric was going about, you know, where is George Bush heading, especially with the rise of the neocons and the rise of more militarists in this next 4 years?
Well, I think a pivotal point in the so-called war on terrorism has come sometime in the last 6 months. You could see it acknowledged, for example, in November with a release of a very small and unimportant government advisory board, the Defense Science Policy Board, but which was the first official government pronouncement that essentially the strategy that the administration has followed in the so-called war on terrorism is a complete and total failure. It could not be more of one. And at the same time, let's say looking before the elections, before the assault on Fallujah in November, it was very clear that the policy on Iraq was a complete and total failure. And there's a sort of a bifurcation in why, but the basic idea is I think the Bush administration has understood that these twin policies, which they have linked simply by they've made it a fait accompli that Iraq is part of the war on terrorism, they have acknowledged internally that what they've done so far has been a complete failure. Now the question is what to do about that failure. You and I and frankly a lot of the foreign policy realists in the establishment would say, well, you have to back off, you have to be not quite so authoritarian, you have to at least pretend to pay more attention to what people in the region want, you have to try to change your policy a little bit at least in order to make it seem less oppressive, and that will help to alleviate the problems, in fact, that have been created by the current approach to the war on terrorism. The neoconservatives have the opposite solution, which is that if this level of force isn't enough, we will dramatically ratchet it up. And so, in fact, after the Fallujah assault in November was a clear sign of this in Iraq, a dramatic ratcheting up of the level of violence in occupied Iraq. And at the time, in November, I predicted that we would also see a ratcheting up of the larger so-called war on terrorism. And I think the things you're talking about, like Seymour Hersh's article in The New Yorker, a recent one by Barton Gellman in The Washington Post, are pointing to exactly that.
Well, one of the things I want to turn this to is, you know, do these contradictions eventually offer some hope for resistance in different ways? And you can take it either from the United States or back, as I said, into Iraq and the Middle East. In the United States, I mean, there are some genuinely positive things. I mean, this madman, you know, given that Kerry ran, you know, a campaign that sort of bordered on somebody committing suicide in public, and still lost by only 3 million votes, and if he had won Ohio, he'd be president. I'm pretty surprised by the consciousness, even if it's a minority consciousness, of the fraud of the Iraq war. There's been two good articles in the, and I believe the New York Times this weekend, about two different returning Iraqi soldier groups. One is, I guess, Iraqi Veterans Against the War, Iraq War Veterans Against the War. And the other one is, I wish I knew its name, maybe you do, sort
of. Operation Truth.
What's that?
Operation Truth.
Right, Operation Truth, which is a more moderate group that's trying to at least just expose the dangers of and the lies of what's going on in Iraq. Having done a lot of anti-war work in Vietnam, you know, during the Vietnam War, this is pretty early for this level of intensified struggle. The other thing is the incredible horrors being inflicted upon the U.S. soldiers coming back. And it's not the primary problem, since they're sent there as aggressors, but they're mainly working class kids and young kids of color coming back with, you know, as Dr. King said, either physical or psychiatric wounds for life. So I have two questions for you. One is, and I know you're involved with United for Peace and Justice and other groups. Why are we having trouble, given the fact that there's such widespread anti-war sentiment, that there's not widespread anti-war activism? In the Vietnam War, the activism increased as the war went on, and here there was really sensational activism before the war, and just about nothing happening now. And secondly, once again, where else do you see discussions of resistance internationally to this neoconservative plan? Because it's pretty much the danger of overextension. I mean, my sense is that they're kidding themselves militarily if they think they're going to take on China and Russia and Cuba and Iran and Iraq, you know, I mean, they can talk big, but they're, so I think there's some international contradictions and some U.S. contradictions. Could you talk about both?
Yeah, with regard to the movement here, this is a complex question. One of the things that feeds into it is I think that the dynamic that we have seen, you know, the large demonstrations before there was even a war, the formation, as you said, of veterans groups against the war so early into it, that dynamic is primarily because of the change in technology. It's not that somehow we're building along the same path we did in the Vietnam War, except faster. It's that the path is completely different. The internet, the rapid dissemination of information, makes it very easy to assemble a big protest. It's also it's a lot easier to afford a quick plane ticket to New York to go and march in a protest for a few hours than it was in the 1960s. There are a lot more people who can do that. So it's a reflection of those kinds of changes, not a reflection of an idea that the movement now is somehow better at organizing or even quicker at organizing necessarily than it was before. It's just technologically able to get its word out wider. And so we have, as you pointed out, we have this dynamic here where nothing grows. You know, maybe that we had a little bit of growing when right before the war, when the protests in January were big and the protests in February were bigger. But in general, the first protest is the biggest and everything kind of goes downhill from there. And I think I think there are a lot of people who are like-minded, who are opposed to this, as many as there were any time except the late stages of the Vietnam War. But there isn't as large a number of really dedicated activists, people who say, you know, first and foremost, I'm part of the movement. I think there were a lot more of those in the Vietnam era than there are now, and that's a real deficit to make up. One thing I would say with regard to the future evolution of the movement is that I do agree with you. I think there is a lot of hope. I think that the opposition to what's happening even within mainstream sectors is very hopeful, but I don't think that opposition means that the anti-war movement should be mainstreaming itself. In fact, I think it's done a little bit too much of that. I think in order to make an effective movement, one that doesn't just criticize Iraq as a quagmire, but that actually generates anger and resistance and desire to change the policy in a serious way, is going to have to take on larger questions like American exceptionalism, like the absurdity of George Bush, of all people, using the word freedom 27 times in his speech, the absurdity of believing that the neoconservatives actually want democracy abroad when it's so clear that, in fact, they're against democracy here, and basically the absurdity of the story that most of us tell ourselves about the role of the United States in the world. And I think that's something that the movement has to take on in a much more coherent way than it has in the past. With regard to the international question, I actually don't see a lot of resistance coming from too many places. I think that the governments that oppose the U.S. drive to war have been mostly trying to get back on board. They will certainly oppose if there is a drive to war with Iran. It's hard to imagine that any country except Israel would support that, and literally any country in the world except Israel would support a U.S. drive to war on Iran. But short of that, they're trying to go back to business as usual. With regard to the Iraqi resistance in particular, I think it's reached a point where it has to make some decisions. I referred to one of them. You've got the Zarqawi and the Wahhabi Sunni extremists who are really trying to foment civil war between the Sunni and Shia, which is a horrible strategy if you're against the occupation because it makes it very easy. You know, those occupiers can sit by and watch you fighting each other. And you've got people like Muqtada al-Sadr making efforts to reach out to the Sunni. He's a Shia. And so one question will be whether the resistance can actually deal with this question. The other will be, in a larger sense, can the resistance come up with a political program and a way of running things, like they didn't find in Fallujah when they ran it for 6 months, that is actually congenial to the people of Iraq who really were very unhappy with Islamic Mujahideen rule in Fallujah. And if they don't solve this basic political problem, It may not be that the United States is going to be able to exterminate them militarily, but they also can't get big enough or powerful enough to push the United States out of Iraq.
Well, this is great. I mean, you have a real facility with a lot of analysis. We're with Rahul Mahajan, who's has about three more minutes with us. Maybe we'll end with, let me see if I'm picking up on your point about the mainstreaming of the movement. I had a lot of disagreements with my friends at War Times, for instance, when they opened up their first issue by saying on September 11th, we were attacked by terrorists, is the first sentence. And I had big debates with, for instance, Max Elbaum to say, you know, what do you mean by we? Like the using the imperial we. And secondly, seeding the word terrorist so quickly when some even more moderate groups put out statements that were more like, we mourn the events of September 11th, and yet we're very concerned about U.S. policy. You know, groups who put that out in the first early stages of, you know, after the those events. I don't know, I'm asking you, I mean, my view is that there needs to be a broad united front. There's no, that's not even the question, but there needs to be a very open anti-racist, anti-imperialist wing of that united front, and that this is a time when left-wing ideas expressed intelligently and non-dogmatically that move to a more systemic critique, because it goes full circle to your point about why don't we have more activists? Well, because we don't have more ideology. We don't have groups based on an ideology. When I was recruited into the movement, I was recruited into a sense of revolution, of world revolution, in a popular sense. So do you think, having made a lot of points here, that the efforts to mainstream the message, to downplay discussions of imperialism, to stick to an anti-war, but not, you know, to sometimes some people even keeping the Palestinian struggle isolated from the Iraqi struggle, leads to a breadth on one hand, but as you pointed out, ultimately a decline in the movement because it's not building a left-wing leadership.
Yeah, and I would go further than that. Even leaving aside the question of leadership, where I agree with you, it's not building a base of people who are really committed. Yes, they may come out to a protest, but we all know that coming out to a protest in and of itself doesn't do much good, especially with this president who frankly laughs every time that the left half of the country protests. He's in fact the more people out there in the streets from the left protesting him, the happier he would be. So it doesn't even build the kind of commitment that's needed to generate, you know, large-scale organizing in the future. And again, I agree with you very much. It must be anything we do right now has to be in a very non-dogmatic, non-doctrinaire way. I do think it's very important to take on this notion of American exceptionalism, but I'm not talking about, you know, let's go around spelling America with a K or with three Ks for that matter, but rather let us say, you know, this is what America is supposed to stand for. This, it's not true. It's never been true. Historically, it's been as false as you could imagine. There have been a few good things about that. There have been a few things about good things about the ethic of liberty in this country that are very much under attack by this administration. But also, there is something that we can shoot for. When you got into the movement in the 60s, the big thing, the real source of energy, even more than opposing the Vietnam War, was the feeling that you were working towards building something new, a better world, a different world. Right now, the left has no analysis of what a new or better America should be. Even, you know, not forget about what America should be in 50 years. What would be a new and better America a year from now? It's not just a laundry list of programs. There's got to be some sense of ideals and values. And there, I think we fall very short when we enter the public dialogue.
Well, what's the last statement?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, we probably have to disagree on the sense that we believe that one of the biggest things, one of the keys, and I think that's one of the aspects that Eric was talking about, which was this concept of there was a world revolution happening. I mean, there was the black people in this country revolting and actually on some level even saying, we deserve a plebiscite. Do we even belong to the United States? You saw here in the Southwest, Chicanos saying, hey, this is our homeland. And so I think there was a different vision of what the United States even was, could be composed or even geographically seemed. And I think that there's a long discussion about where the movement should be heading for the war, but we'd like to thank Rahul Mahajan with EmpireNotes.org. Rahul, is that the main place where they can get a hold of you? Can you give us an email where people can get a hold of you?
Yeah, you can click on my name there or just email rahul@empirenotes.org.
So thank you, Rahul Mahajan. We'll be right back with Craig Gilmore of California Prison Moratorium and the upcoming L.A. City Council vote to put a measure to approve a citywide half-cent sales tax for more cops in Los Angeles. So stay tuned.